kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe, as I have a bunch of gunk in my throat, so we're starting off wonderfully. Purnell's here. Purnell, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I want nothing to do with the gunk in your throat. Weather is great, as it should be. I'm talking to old people over here about basketball and metaphorical life situations.
Interesting.
It's been a weird day for that, talking to my old senior neighbor. And you started wanting to talk my head off about old classic life incidents and happenstances. And he started asking me about my childhood. And it's like he wanted someone to talk to, and no one's doing that for him at his home. So it ended up working out in my favor because I actually enjoyed the conversation. But it was unexpectedly nice. And also, of course, well, it's not really of course. I actually started up, though it's a slow burn, playing Sonic Mania, finally. Ooh. Not because it's free on PS4, because I actually bought it years ago for that cool statue they gave with it.
Yeah, but boy, that's an awesome collector edition.
It really is. The funny thing is, being a typical collector, it's still in the box, but the entire box is shelled because I like the box itself. Like, where'd you get the collector's edition for? The statue. Where's the statue? In the box. What? Yeah, I didn't want to take it out. It's just, but you know it's in there. But the box is cool, too, and that's enough for me.
See, I like having that one out because you could hit the switch on it, and it goes, Sega!
You have to put batteries in for that, though, right?
It might have batteries already. I don't remember.
Oh, if it had batteries inside, those things have exploded by now. Unfortunately. One used and busted collectible.
Nice.
But so far, it's an interesting little game, though. By the end of the month, I'm going to have to come up with a whole... I'm playing it for Rhythm and Pixels Game of the Month. So by the end of the month, I decided I'm going to have to sit down and be like, okay, now that I've played this, you know, the revival of Classic Sonic and all of its glory, I can actually talk about how I feel about it compared to, quote-unquote, modern Sonic games and, you know, the fact that I might be one of 20 people on the planet that actually think modern Sonic games can be fun. So it should be a trip.
They have their moments, but overall, I don't know. I'm not a fan of the 3D Sonic games.
I think the majority of the issues they tend to have is when the company itself can't get the damn camera right or the controls are wonky. But when they get those right, which happens in some of the games, it is being a fair bit of fun. Though it's a matter of perspective in that with, say, a Sonic Classic, I think it's funny, I'm already kind of like a preemptive on it. On a Sonic Classic, it scrolls left to right, and you get aspects of momentum, and the challenge lies in the fact that you're just kind of not trying not to die, and that you get lost in the levels, but I don't know too many people that like can run through those levels and be like, okay, I know exactly where I'm going and exactly what I'm doing. I'm doing all this wacky stuff, and I get to the end. Now, it's usually like stop and go, jump, just moving forward until you get to the end. One way or the other, you're just moving forward when the game allows you to go forward. Not saying it's not fun. It's a lot of fun. It's just, that's honestly how I feel about Sonic. That's been every level in Sonic Mania so far, too. It's like, can I go forward? I'm doing that. Go backwards. Why the hell would I do that? No, go forward. whereas with Sonic Modern, they are more like roller coasters than anything else, I think. Like, a well-designed modern Sonic stage feels more like a roller coaster. And it's all about keeping your speed up, occasionally jumping while being fast, and looking for offbeat routes as you're going forward to acquire items and rings. But you really can't get lost in a modern Sonic game because the whole point is just to blast through the stage as the fastest thing alive. It works. Though, I think there's something to be said about combining the two, which is why, of course, Sonic Generations was freaking amazing. Because you got the best of both worlds. If you wanted to explore a stage, you had that in the classic ones. If you wanted to freaking go fast, you had that in the modern levels. It was wonderful. They should have made a Sonic Generations 2, but instead we got Sonic Forces. What the fuck was wrong with Sega? Oh, yeah, cocaine. It was a terrible, terrible idea. I don't know what they were thinking. In the trailer, really got my hopes up. I was like, you're not just like, Dr. Robotnik's going to win. And you're like, you have to stop. It's like, but you won't do it alone. It's like, oh my gosh, that classic Sonic guy, he's back. What's happening? Sonic Jerry's here. No. You get to create a furry.
Yay.
Get a cool grappling hook gun that you've never needed in this series ever. You look like the kid from Persona sometimes. You get the collector the day one. It is just dumb. It was a terrible idea. Whoever came up with that when Generations 2 was sitting right there waiting for me to get punched in the stomach. It was a terrible idea. Oh my God, I'm ranting for nothing. People are probably listening to this like, God, I didn't come here for Sonic. You should have. But I understand that you didn't. But you should have.
Like, oh, Purnell.
Sonic the Hedgehog.
I love when you go on your rants.
It's something I feel like I need to do. It's like the old man I saw earlier. He was like, I just need to talk to a human being. You are very friendly. Let me tell you about my time in high school and how I coached AJ English. But me, I'm like, let me tell you about some weird shit that's going through my head right now. I got to regurgitate it right now on the microphone, and everyone needs to hear it. I want to talk to you all about Sonic.
Well, that's what this show is for, to get things off your chest.
About Sonic?
Oh, why not? It's video game related.
Also, fun thing since Sonic is up. This is just a funny moment in the life of Purnell. So, I have as you already know from talking to me in general, dating has been the bane of my existence. I'm having a really hard time meeting women, whatever. But there was one time where I did meet a person, and I was like, okay, dating is hard. I got to try to make this work as best I can, because I don't feel like going back out there to try to meet somebody else. I met her at a speed dating event. So as you can guess, there wasn't a lot of time for introductions, just blah, 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 blah. Tony, 3 minutes are up. Let's just do something later. So this woman was hard to say, all over the place a bit. But the thing that actually threw me off, it wasn't the fact that her conversation skills were lacking. It wasn't the fact that she slurped spaghetti all over her freaking face. It was the fact that she was obsessed with Sonic the Hedgehog to the point of Sonic fan fiction, getting really up close and personal about Sonic erotica and tier matching Sonic characters. Like, Sonic may as well have been her live-in roommate for as much as she was all about Sonic's life. It was crazy. I feel very uncomfortable right now. I like the Sonic the Hedgehog games, but you love the Sonic the Hedgehog characters in a way that I didn't think was humanly possible. We need to leave. Separation is now. I can't do this shit. Mercy, mercy me.
So when's the next date?
Oh, there is none. We're still friends, more or less, but at the same time, I was like, I can't. I just can't. And of course, she's married now, and I'm still trying to meet somebody. So, hey, she won, but nonetheless, Sonic, God, Jesus, it was creepy. I couldn't do it.
That's incredible.
It's wild. And to this day, she's still like that. What was it? When they announced the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, it was just constant stuff. Just nitpicking every little bit about Sonic. His personality, his shoes, how his quills looked. She didn't care about Dr. Robotnik, because he's just a god. But this is a hedgehog. A blue one. Like, he's supposed to be sexy and very fast and very seductive with his dulcet tones.
Oh, my God.
Gotta go fast. Like, all exactly right. That.
Gotta go fast, baby.
It's Barry White the Hedgehog.
Gonna lay you down. Gotta go fast.
Gotta go fast by the fire.
Oh, Jesus, what is wrong with us?
I don't even know. I'm going to assume it's carbonated water.
Yeah, probably.
Carbonated water, the bubbles went to her head, and then things happened, and bada bing, bada boom, how's the weather? Sonic.
Well, should we start some reviews?
Are we reviewing Sonic the Hedgehogs?
Sadly, no.
Are we reviewing our favorite chili dogs?
No, you're going to review the games you played this week.
Oh, Chili Dog Busters. Got you.
Yes, exactly. All right. First game to talk about tonight is called Legend of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel 2, developed by Nihon Falcom, published by Xseed Games, released June 4th on PS4 for $49.99. Civil war has broken out across Erebonia. After his narrow escape from Trista, Rian will take up his sword once again on a journey with his divine knight Valimar in search of his friends from Class 7 and a way to end the conflict before its price becomes far too dear. Purnell, tell us about Trails of Cold Steel 2.
I want to flat out say before anything else, I am glad that your description was very spoiler-free. It just gives you a very light scenario and it leaves you with a bunch of questions. And that's perfect because I'm not talking crap about the plot. Except to say that in typical Falcom fashion, they did a fantastic job following up the events of Cold Steel 1, in which this one takes place borderline immediately after. So if you have not played Cold Steel 1, I am going to advise you, not in a sense as to say you could not play this without playing Cold Steel 1, but honestly, why in the hell would you do that? If you have not played Cold Steel 1, you should go back and play that and not even worry about what we're talking about right the hell now. However, if you have played through Cold Steel 1, you should be eager to play this game even without us talking about it. But I'm just letting you know that the plot holds up. It continues to move at a great pace, and you will not be disappointed in that element. So look forward to it. Now, gameplay-wise, however. So, Trails of Cold Steel 2 starts out very, you know, pretty hectic. It moves at the from the very beginning with you moving through the game, getting you reintroduced to the battle system and to just general mechanics like how to play the game and just elements of healing and art usage and things of that nature. However, a few things have been changed from the previous game. One, they carry over experience levels and stats. So don't expect to start this game having to start from level 1 and build Rian and his friends back up to stuff, because the game kind of assumes that you are as strong as you were for the most part after the first game. So while you don't carry all your inventory over, you do start out at like level 40, 45 or so. You start out pretty well off. So the game is already starting out with you fighting hard guys. The first boss alone, if you're not careful, and especially if you're like me playing on hard mode, he will give you some work. I'm talking every turn he heals for, like every three turns he heals for 10, 15,000 hit points because, again, the game's like, you've been at this. You know what you're doing.
Damn.
It's beautiful, though. Next thing is that the link system is back from the previous game. Link systems was a combat mechanic where you could have two characters partner up with each other on the battlefield. And when one does an attack that inflicts a staggering effect on an enemy, usually based on like a weakness, elemental, or mostly physical though, you can have your team-up character come in with a follow-up attack. You can say, hey, hit him. He's like, okay, no problem. And the more you do this with a character, the more you build your link bond up with them, which allows you for better and better support moves. Sometimes a really powerful finishing move if the guy is near death, or just like a nice cool combo. However, they added something else called Rush. What that is every time you pull off one of the usual link attacks, you'll get something called a bravery point. And when you get three or more bravery points, the next time you pull off an effect like that, you can initiate Rush, which is a combo attack where your characters, the main guy and their partner, can hit every enemy on the battlefield for decent damage. Nothing super major, but again, in this game where you've got guys healing for fair amounts of hit points, you want to keep the damage heavy and strong as much as possible. So this is a very useful mechanic. In addition to that, there's also something known as overdrive, which is added to this game. When you take damage and give damage, there's a gauge in the upper right corner that eventually gets unlocked, and it gets filled up. Once it maxes out, you are allowed to choose at will to activate overdrive. And when you do, the character who activates it and their linked character gets a big hit point and MP boost, like regeneration, and they get three uninterrupted turns of action in combat. So we're talking like flat steamrolls. And you are allowed to, basically all your magic arts are immediate, so you don't have to worry about the time delay that usually comes with them. It basically just means allows you to lay on the hurt. Also, every attack will do stagger, which means you can just do link and follow-up combos too. So while this is not going to be breaking battles and just giving you easy wins against bosses, again, it's more love for the beatdown, and you can't fault that. It's glorious.
Beatdowns are always good.
You damn right they're good, especially when they're rhythmic. I love rhythmic beatdowns. Also, in the previous Trails game, when you went to the when you used the art system, it involved you linking, I guess, like I want to call them materia so badly, but I'm just going to call them they're ornaments. It had you linking ornaments to slots on your Arcus unit. God, that sounds cryptic, but think of it like a materia like chain where you would put the materia into like a slot of connected bars. And depending on how you put them in, that's the skills you had for combat. Similar thing in this. And in the previous game, you had to spend money to unlock different slots so you could put more stuff in. But in this game, they're assuming that you already did all that in the previous game. So what they do to make up for it is now you get rare and ultra rare quartz that lets you do very special things that you didn't have in the previous game. But you can't equip all of those until you upgrade other slots on your Arcus unit so that you can store those more powerful quartz units. So rather than make you reopen up all of your slots, it just has you upgrade those slots to better to serve a better purpose. So I actually like that quite a bit. They did add one new combat type too. Every once in a blue moon, as Joe mentioned earlier, there's a character, quote unquote, named Valimar now. It is a mech suit that the main character gains access to. And he can board it, and he uses it to combat other mechs in combat. When this battle occurs, what ends up happening is that the mechs kind of go into a sort of stance, a series of stances, and the stances are sort of cues for what type of attack they're going to do, or what kind of motion they're going to do. When you see that, your character is able to target either their head, their body, or their legs. Oh, sorry, their head, their arm, or their body. And if you hit the right spot, you can get a stagger effect on them, which kind of lets you get like a follow-up attack to do more damage. But by the same token, the enemy's kind of watching for what you do, and if you hit them in the wrong way, they can swing around the side and hit you for like a counterattack. So it's almost like a sort of rock, paper, scissors deal. And, of course, as you're doing this, you're also building CP up just like you do in normal combat. And the CP will allow you to do, like, special attacks with the mech with Valimar. You'll get more, of course, as you play the game. And as you start coming up across other members of Class 7, they can sort of sub-integrate as a secondary support to Valimar to give you more support options and combat options. So it honestly ends up working out pretty well. Doesn't the battles aren't exactly the same as the traditional, but it's a nice change of pace. And it doesn't hurt the game in any way. Though, of course, I personally feel like I still prefer normal combat, but it's like Xenogears Lite. And then I don't hate combat in this game, whereas I hated combat in the mechs in Xenogears. Fight me, I don't care. I hated the mech combat in that game. So, aside from that, the game, like I said, is still fantastic. It starts out at a fairly brisk pace, though for better or worse in a wacky way, the game still has the mission system that the first game had. And I think it's kind of funny how they throw it in there because it's like, really, is this, you're going to do this in the middle of a war, but whatever, what do I freaking know? But what happens with the system I'm referring to is that at certain intervals in the game, you will be asked to perform a series of tasks, like missions, I'll say. Might be say, hey, go kill this monster that's terrorizing citizens on the highway, or deliver this medicine to the guy down at the flower shop, whatever. And depending on what you do and how well you perform those missions, you'll get rewards in the form of money, sometimes items or new ornaments or whatever. And at the end of every chapter in the game, or act, depending on who you want to say, you will get a score based on how well you did. And for every certain threshold of those score points, you'll go up a rank, and each rank increase will give you a bonus item, again, like an ornament or armor or something like that. So it behooves you to go about trying to complete those missions. And if you manage to get every mission done perfectly, good luck with that, by the way. I believe there's an actual reward for you in that, though I have not pulled it off. Bite me, game, because it will never happen. But if you're that guy, you got an FAQ or something, go knock yourself out. But all in all, this game is worth, I've been saying it before, I say it on every forum that I can say it on, and I'll say it here too. This series, not just the game I'm reviewing, but this series is the bee's freaking knees. And if you're sleeping on this and you like JRPGs, I don't know what to say to you. This is where it's at. What is worth, though, people might tell you something like you need to play Trails in the Sky, which was originally released on the PSP and then eventually hit Steam. Some might say you need to play Ao no Kiseki or the Crossbell games, which never even came to freaking America, so those guys can suck off. But in the end, you only need to play Trails 1 and Trails 2 to appreciate these games. If you play Trails in the Sky, or heaven forbid you found a way to play the other two games I just named, it'll just make the experience exponentially better. But they're not required to experience and enjoy this game series, the Just Trails and the Cold Steel games. They are worth your time. They are spectacular games. Falcom deserves a damn medal for putting them out. And I appreciate I think this is XSEED still, right? Because this is until the third game.
Yeah, this one's still XSEED.
I am so appreciative of XSEED for having done all these games, because I've been on board with them since Trails in the Sky came out, and they have not done me wrong this whole time. So you should buy this game, because not just because I'm saying to, but because you owe it to yourself to have a fantastic JRPG experience and a number of years where we've honestly been kind of light on them. Like, there's been indie ones, but as far as like spectacle games, I'm looking at my shelf, there aren't a ton. There haven't been a lot. So,
yeah.
And considering that that's the case, and for this one to be as good as it is, shoot, this isn't a pity game. This is just a genuinely good game, and you should play it.
Awesome.
Yes.
All right.
Awesome.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Slay the Spire, developed by Megacrit LLC, published by Humble Bundle, released May 21st on PS4 for $24.99. We fuse card games and roguelikes together to make the best single-player deck builder we could. Craft a unique deck, encounter bizarre creatures, discover relics of immense power, and slay the spire. Purnell, tell us about it.
This is a game that I've been hearing about for quite a while via PC. From people who would talk about how great it is. And I would go and look up imagery of it to try to get a handle for what it was. And I was like, it doesn't look all that appealing to me. It didn't really stand out to me on the graphics department and stills and all that. So I never really felt drawn to it. And then it came to console, and I was able to actually play it on a controller in my house. And I can tell you flat out, all of those people knew exactly what the hell they were talking about, and I've been sleeping on a product of great joy. What the hell was I doing? Slay the Spire is a fun, fantastic ride, and it doesn't ride on a narrative, so you don't have to really sit there and process a bunch of information to enjoy the game. You just do it. What the hell is Slay the Spire? Well, I'll tell you. The game starts out with you choosing one of multiple characters. You start with one, you unlock more as you play the game. When you pick a character, they start with a default deck of cards. It's typically pretty small. We're talking like, I want to say 10 cards or so. And you have to choose from a randomly generated assortment of rooms and maps. You have to choose one of three starting paths you can take that go up, pretty much like up a tower. And depending on which path you take determines the route in which you'll progress to the tower. And while you progress, you go through a series of rooms. So the first room is typically a monster, because it just makes sense to make you fight in the first room. Other rooms might be treasure or merchants or whatever, but I'll get into those in a second. So what happens when you actually play the game? So let's just say you're fighting a monster. The way the game works is that you have, I guess, call them orbs. And orbs work as action currency. So action points. Boom. Simple stuff. You get action points. That determines how many actions you can do. And whenever you get some cards pulled, think a hand of five cards. Each card denotes an action, and each action costs a certain number of action points. You can use as many actions in one turn as your action points will allow. And you have action that can devote to a series of things. It can be an attack. It can be a spell that can help you, depending on who you're using. It could be like, let's say, an effect that could bolster. And the idea is that you want to chain these as best as possible to do as much damage to enemies. Now, sometimes, however, the enemy well, actually, he's not sometimes, all the time, the enemy will choreograph what his next move is going to be. And sometimes he'll be doing an attack, and he'll have a sword in the corner above his head that says this is what he's going to do. Sometimes he'll actually want to do like a buff, or he'll do like a status effect, and there's symbols for all of those things. Now, when this occurs, you might find yourself wanting to not attack, but to defend instead. And the way you defend is that sometimes you have cards that will specifically denote defense. So it might say, use this card to get 5 defense points. Use this card to get 8 defense points. And when you use that card and end your turn, the enemy will do his attack. And if you have enough defense to ride out his attack level, it'll just absorb it and you won't take damage. Otherwise, you'll take the difference of the defense and the attack. So you're being strategic to try to balance out these things. Hit hard, defend hard, not die. Now, every time you win a fight, you'll get a reward. Sometimes a potion, which can be used mid-battle to do a number of effects, like heal you or let you draw an extra card or whatever. Sometimes you'll get money, which can be used to buy new cards and items and relics from merchants. I'll get to relics in a second. And also, you'll get the option to get one new card. And the cards come in a variety of different effects. Tons of different card types. All of them, in my opinion, so far have been cool things. I have never looked at the card in this game and said, huh, that's a turd ability. Who the hell would ever want to use that? That has never happened, ever. It's great. So you get to choose a new card and take it with you. If you come across a merchant, like I said, you can buy new stuff. And one of the things that I mentioned that I didn't describe yet is a relic. Relics are consistent passive abilities that you can get. So one might say, for as long as you have this, when you use attacks that have strike in them, you might get like they'll do like an extra 2 damage or something. Or you might get one that says gain 1 extra action point, but as a result of that, you'll get 2 wound cards added to your deck. And just for the record of stating what they are, wound cards are added to your deck and they're just dead cards. If you draw them, they can't do anything for you, so they suck. But so when you get them, it's an interesting trade-off, and honestly, I like that effect because I'm like, hey, using the bonus attack action point, I can do more damage when the cards are right, and I just soak it up when I deal with it when the wound comes up, but whatever. So relics are freaking awesome, and they really have a habit of changing the way your momentum the game's momentum goes. So as you're playing the game, you're just constantly ascending the spire. Every once in a while, you'll also come across a campfire site. When you're at a campfire site, you get one of 2 options. You can either rest to get a portion of your hit points back, or you can visit a blacksmith, because apparently blacksmiths hang out near fires in a tower. What the hell do I know? And the blacksmith, what he'll do is he'll upgrade one of your cards to an advanced form, free of charge. It just happens. And honestly, I found that to be an enjoyable aspect of the game, too. It was nice to go to the blacksmith and say, okay, cool, I'm here and I have 20 cards. Let's see what all these cards have for an updated ability. And it's pretty awesome because sometimes it can take a card that was only moderately useful and make it extremely useful. Like I had one card that said you get 2 action points, but it cost me like 1 or 2 action points to use it. But after I upgraded it, it was 2 action points, but it cost me nothing to use it. So just by having it, I got 2 free points. It was glorious. But it ended up being a fantastic system in that regard. At the end of each section of the tower, you'll fight a boss. And the bosses are pretty freaking awesome fights. And early on in the game, do not be surprised they are kicking the snot out of you, because compared to the normal enemies in the tower, they truly are bosses. They usually come with much more hit points. They're more aggressive. And I'm talking like a guy will do, I think I had one guy who did 10 damage 8 times and my max hit points was 100. It was like, whoosh, how do you deal with that? The answer is by doing a really good job of managing your cards, because otherwise you will get roasted. But the challenge is not insurmountable. And it is a lot of fun, because when you actually pull off these wins, you genuinely feel like you got a handle on the cards you've been dealt. And one thing worth mentioning for those who might suffer from this, like me, analysis paralysis is not of concern in this game. This is not a game where you get 40 cards and you have to properly shuffle and manage them. What happens in this game is you get, like I said, you get 10 and you'll get one new card after every battle, and you can buy new cards from the merchant. And
I'm sorry about that.
No worries. And you can spend money if you really feel the need to purge a card from your deck. But since you're starting with from humble beginnings and personally adding each new card to your deck, it becomes way easier to determine what you don't want if it comes time for you to actually take something out of your deck. And if you don't want to, you don't have to. There's no reason. Though sometimes you'll get a card through way of a curse or something where it will be intentionally bad and you'll want to get it out of your deck. So at that time, it's like, hey, thank you for letting me purge this card, merchant, whatever. So, but honestly, this game has proven to be crack. Like, it's good, good. I booted it up one night just to see, the first night I actually got it, just to see what it was like, thinking, okay, I only want to play for like an hour. I'll resume it later or another day to see what it's like. I started playing it at like 9 o'clock. I ain't go to bed till 2.
Damn.
This game is a lot of fun, and time will just fly by while you're playing it. It is a gem.
Well, do I even need to ask? $25? What do you think?
I honestly think it's worth the money. As long as you're content with the idea of, you know, actually, I don't know, investing time in the games you play, this is one that will pay you back in dividends. It is worth the money and is a definite buy title.
Man, that's 2 in a row.
Tic-tac-toe coming up.
I guess we'll find out, because the next game to talk about is called Risk System, developed and published by Newt Industries, released May 14th on Steam for $11.99. High-speed kinetic action, danger is the best offense. Purnell, what do they mean?
Well, let me see. So this game has a plot. So I'm sorry to tell you this, Newt and you, but I wasn't paying much attention to the plot. I'm terrible for that when it comes to shmups. It's just who I am. But gameplay-wise, what they mean is, as you play, there's a lot of shooters out there, like say companies like Cave or whatever, and they'll tend to have a thing called people like to call it scratch paint bonuses. And what happens is, if a bullet kind of scrapes by the side of your ship, you'll get bonus points added to your score. It's not a requirement. It's just kind of there if you're obsessed with getting more and more points. However, Risk System decided to make it an actual requirement to gameplay. In this game, you are not only enticed to, but are required to put your ship in harm's way constantly in order to build up damage. So as you're flying through stages in your cool ship, there is no fire button for the gun. The gun fires automatically when it sees a guy in front of it to take out. And that might sound stupid at first, but it's not, because one, typically when you're playing a shmup, you're always holding down the fire button anyway. There's no reason not to let up on it. And two, it allows you to focus more on just not dying, which you will need to do because there's a lot happening on the screen on certain stages. But as you're playing the game, enemies will fly at you and your ship will start firing bullets. Those bullets do monk for damage. They're like kind of pew pew pews. However, what happens is whenever enemies fire bullets or an enemy even flies by your ship, if they're close to you, pretty much just outside your hitbox, your ship will kind of have like a resonance effect against it. And while that resonation is occurring, your bullets will become larger and do more damage. In addition to that, it will boost something called like a barrier reflect gauge or something like that. I can't remember what it was called, like barrier release or barrier reflect. And when it's maxed out, you will perform a screen wiping attack that hits enemies in both the foreground and the background of the screen. Now, you can't hit anyone in the background by any other means aside from using this attack. And there are enemies who will be attacking you from the background, exclusively from the background. So you'll need to make proper use of this ability. In addition to just doing the screen wipe, it also makes you invincible for a short period of time. And there are moments in the game where you will need to be invincible to survive. As in, if you're not invincible, you will take damage and you will possibly die. So as you're playing through the game, you'll be dealing with multiple scenarios where enemies are coming at you from the right-hand side of the screen. Enemies are coming at you from the background, launching missiles at you. And you have to dodge and blast and barrier release all the way to the long day. While I didn't mention that there's no gunfire button, there are two buttons that can be used to barrel roll up and down respectively. So It gives you a little bit more. And how? And you will be rolling and tussling. There's actually moments where, like, the enemy will have like a crosshair on you, and the only way you'll be able to get out of the way in time is by barrel rolling at just the right time. So imagine fighting enemies in the foreground who are launching fireballs at you that you're trying to scrape by in order to get the risk damage improvement. And also, you're listening and watching for cursors shooting at you from the background that you have to dodge. And all this is resulting in lots of bright, flashy lights. Suffice it to say, you'll have your work cut out for you. And it's a lot of fun to play as you're dealing with it. And bosses make you put in that work, too, because they do all kinds of crazy dances with, like, lasers that just stay lit. And you have to kind of dodge through them by using your barrier release and scrape. You're basically scraping just enough to get a barrier release just in time before the laser hits you officially. And it's a lot of fun. Like, this game, I think it's cool that they went with this system, because for all the shmups that I've played, I can't think of one that's played this way before. I've seen games where they kind of have as an option, like I said, scratching the paint. But I've never seen one quite like this, where they force you to make use of the invincibility mechanic, and they force you to make use of risk-defying activities. It is a lot of fun. And honestly, it's kind of cool that it came from a studio that up until this game, I had never heard of. It goes to show you that there's a lot of life out there in indie development.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes it just needs the means of which to get that out there for people to try.
And fingers crossed that they might have console plans for this. Do you know anything?
Unfortunately not, but I'm going to wager, just like with a lot of these guys, where if the money comes through so they can get those ports out, maybe, and I can tell you right now, if that happens, I'm on board.
Me too, because
I always prefer console to PC. Yeah, it is great. It's a good game. Music's good. The gameplay is solid, fantastic. And I also like the idea of, like, the gun, like I said, the gun firing on its own. Because, yeah, I get there are games where, like, say, Radiant Silvergun, we have six different guns, so you need to have full control over your firearms. But a lot of shooters, you really aren't doing nothing but holding down fire, even when guys aren't on the screen, because, quite frankly, you're just like, well, there's no real incentive for letting off the gun button. So I think it's kind of nice they say, don't worry about that. Pew pew's on us. You worry about everything else.
All right. Well, $12 on Risk System. What do you say?
I think this is also a bite. This has been a really easy episode for reviews. Everything I've played has been very nice. Very nice. Borat.
That is very good to hear. I like when we have these episodes.
I do too. I just concerned me because I feel like a listener could be like, he's totally bought and sold by the industry. He likes everything. Hey, Mikey, like, hey, look here, buddy. Games can be good, you know. There's no ratio of every five games, one of them has to be bad. No, that just means we're lucking out. We come across games that we've never heard of that end up being freaking great.
Well, should we go for four in a row?
Tic-tac-toe. Wait, that's not tic-tac-toe. That's Connect Four. Yeah, there it is.
Connect Four. It's in the name.
No, it's not. It's, where is it in the name? There's no match the games in Connect Four.
Oh, Purnell, what are we going to do with you?
Review a fourth game.
Okay, then. Last game that you're here to talk about is called Vectronom, developed by Ludopium. God, this is a weird company. Ludopium. Yeah, we'll go with Ludopium. Published by Art Experience. Released May 29th on the Switch for $9.99. Feel like solving three-dimensional riddles to a frenetic electronic soundtrack? Let Vectronom inject its colorful madness into your life. It's easy to get into the groove, but can you stick to the beat? Purnell, tell us about Vectronom.
They're not lying about that. It is very easy to get into the game because there's no buttons. It's just maneuvering a square across rectangular landscapes. That's the entire freaking game. And if that was all it was without any nuance, this could probably be a considerably bland title. But fortunately, that is not all this game has. And the added thing that I'm going to mention shortly is worth its weight in gold. So, the gameplay consists of your square maneuvering this landscape. The landscape warps and changes as you play the game. And it's not based on what you do, it's based on what the music does. Because for each stage, there is a track that is playing, and for every beat, something changes. Whether the map will shift and warp to make some ledges, it will shift and warp. Sometimes ledges will appear while others will disappear. Sometimes spikes will appear and then disappear, and other such nuances that can occur as you play through the game. What ends up happening is, as you are watching this, you are trying to get a handle on the beat, and then using that beat and your own rhythmic abilities to maneuver your square to the end of the stage. When you get to the end of the stage, the game will then make you redo the previous session with an increased tempo and updated mechanics. So, whereas one section might have you, I don't know, just like walking across a set of ledges that are appearing and disappearing, the next time there will be more ledges that are appearing and disappearing, and they'll add some spikes in there. This happens 3 times, and at the end of the 3rd run, you're considered as having beaten that actual stage, and you'll get graded on 1, how many times it took, how many times you died, 2, if you managed to pick up every little pickup box that's in the stage, which, for the record, they're not always just visible. Sometimes they'll appear and disappear to the beat too, which means you have to be in a specific place at a specific beat to get the box. It really screws with you. Trust me on that. And then the last one is your beat proficiency. How on beat were you with every movement you took? This rating in particular threw me off quite a bit at times, because I'm generally known as being a guy who's got quite a bit of rhythm and he's able to stay on beat, especially in music games. And yet for a while, like, I could never deliberately nail that rating at 100%. Never pulled it off. However, it's when I'm not trying to, and I'm instead just playing the game, that I've nailed 100% beat proficiency on a few stages. And it feels really good when you do, because I don't expect it. It just happens. But you'll be trying and failing until you just get it right unexpectedly. And it's awesome. The game takes place over a series of stages. You're able to go back from the main screen and redo stages if you want to go back and try to get the high scores or whatever. Like I mentioned before, there are no retries, all pickups, and 100% beat proficiency. But on the main story run, when you beat a set of stages, you're done, and you have to move forward. There aren't a ton of stages in the game, but the ones that are there feel good to do. And as you get further in, they become much harder to do. So there's going to be a lot of gameplay involved in redoing stages that you just barely squeaked by after dying a considerable number of times, with the hope being that this time you're going to perfect that bad boy and get all the goods and master the level. I feel as though this game is simple, yet also unique in its execution, and unique in a way that feels fun to engage in. It's not a chore. It's not monotonous. It's simple yet effective, and quite effective at that. I had tons of fun with this game. Highly recommend it to play with headphones on, though, because, again, it's so dependent on the music that you might want to absorb that. Though, of course, if you're not playing on handheld mode, there's nothing to stop you from getting some really decent speakers and just turning the volume up, too.
Yeah.
But as you know about me on this show, I'm almost exclusively handheld, so that's how I live. That's how I roll, baby.
Bust out the headphones, then.
That's right. And it's a fantastic time. Also, I'm going to wager that if you have epileptic issues, you might have concerns with the lighting in the game, because there's a lot of flashing and such. But otherwise, I had a fantastic time with this game. I have no complaints. It's simple, yet extremely effective.
Well, then $10. What do you say?
Vector nom 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 it up. It's a buy.
Awesome. That is 4 for 4 for you this week.
It is, which means next week I got to play something like Grandma Moses Tiddlywink Adventure and just really sob about it.
Yeah, we got to find you something shitty.
We do. Though I'm sure, I don't think any developer wants to be the guy's like, I'm going to be the game he hates. But if you really do feel that way, you're welcome to try. I am all about the attempts.
All right. Well, Purnell, always good having you on chatting. Do you have any final words before we move on?
I just have to say, now that I made that comment, it makes me wonder. There used to be a place near me that sold pizza, and their moniker for selling that pizza was World's Worst Pizza. Of course, what that meant is that people would show up at the store and go, I got to try this pizza that's supposed to be so bad. Give me some. And they eat the pizza and go, this pizza is actually really good. I want more of it. And it's like, I know, right? And the idea being, of course, that they intentionally marketed a shitty product with the intent being to get you inside to see how bad it could be and then wow you with it. I want a game that does that. I want a game that outright says, this is the worst game you will ever play. Our game sucks. boom, boom, boom. And then have people go, this is the best game I've ever played. Why was their marketing so terrible? Intentional. I'm just curious to see if it would even work in the video game industry.
It might.
And we'd be the ones that initiated. It's like, hey, we heard the SML podcast make that comment. We took them up on the challenge. Play this piece of shit. It is hot trash on a butter toasted bun. Bite it.
All right, moving on. Jacob Garner's here. Jacob, how are you doing?
I'm doing. I had a heck of an evening. I just got done recording some videos for an interview, for a job that I'm interviewing for. Which, you know, if anybody from Urban is listening, I'm totally not interviewing for anything.
That's funny that you think we have listeners.
I know. Which, by the way, I've been meaning to discuss that with you, too, about, you know, expanding the podcast. But we'll get to that later off air.
Okay.
All right, fine. I don't know. What about getting like a distributor, like an actual distributor?
Like, what do you mean?
Well, it turns out like iHeartRadio actually has like a submission form, and it's like five questions, and I guess like you submit the site and like a copy of your podcast, and like they'll decide whether they host it on their network. They have like 10,000 odd podcasts.
Huh.
And I was just like, why the fuck not? I mean, how could the SML podcast be any worse than one of those 10,000?
I mean, we could definitely be worse than most.
We could. Yeah, we could. But I mean, like, it could be cool. And then you could be like, hey, I'm on the iHeartRadio network. You should give me Mortal Kombat 11. You know.
You just can't get over that, can you?
Oh, God. I'm like, I read it's going to be on sale during the E3 sale, and I'm just like, oh, please be cheap. Like, I really want that in the season pass to be like $20. I would spring for $20 right now. I don't know.
For the game and the season pass to be $20.
I could dream. I could
Jesus
dream.
Christ, man.
I could dream. You know? But I mean, like, I'm about to be on a big game spending spree anyway. So this is the news that I read that I'm going to spoil, and like, you're probably just going to discuss it during the News of the Week podcast later in the week anyway, if it turns out to be true.
Okay.
So apparently, a bunch of Telltale games are going to get removed from online stores as of June 25th. Now, a couple of them have been removed, like the Minecraft games have already been removed from Steam and GOG.
Yeah, the Telltale games have been dropping off of marketplaces like crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can still get both Batman. I think Jurassic Park is still available. Game of Thrones is not. Tales of the Borderlands is still there. Walking Dead obviously is. What the heck else? Oh, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm not actually sure if that's available still.
I don't know.
I mean, I know you can buy the disc from the Microsoft store for like $12, which I might just do anyway. But yeah, so not only, but here's the real shit kicker. So not only are they going to get delisted on the 25th, there is also a strong possibility that you will not be able to download them. Like,
yeah, again. I heard about that.
And I was just like, oh my God. Like, so not only do I need to get a hard drive for my Xbox One, but now I got to get all these damn games too before they go away. Because otherwise, the only way I'm going to be able to play these games is if I go visit you. And frankly, no, sir.
Well, fuck you too.
But yeah, like, honestly, like, I'm kind of freaked out about that because it's just like, I could understand if they're delisted. Like, fine, whatever. Shit gets delisted all the time.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, you may, like, somebody who, like, is familiar with Mojang and all this other kind of stuff is, like, Yeah, make sure you download it and make sure you update it so it has all the, like, the localization patches and all the other kind of shit. Because it may not be able to be downloaded ever again. Is like, like, it's kind of like a what? Because, like, I don't know. Microsoft made it pretty clear that they, like, if you at this point, if you've down, like, if you've bought something from their store, they intend for you to like keep it forever.
Yeah.
And it's just, what now? Because, like, what? They just couldn't buy the rights to the Minecraft series? Like, what? I mean, they own Minecraft, so they couldn't just, you know, fork over a few million to own this, too?
Well, like, we don't know the legalities behind all of this. There's so much more in contracts and legalities than we could ever be aware of.
Right, I understand that, but I mean, it's still, I'm kind of surprised that, like, Microsoft isn't stepping in to, like, at least protect its own IP. Supposedly, 2K Games is trying to figure out how to get Tales from the Borderlands to stay online, yeah, because Borderlands 3 is going to include characters from that game.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm kind of freaked out about that.
I don't know. I wouldn't be too worked up about it. They're just games. It's just games, man.
Yeah, I know, but then it's like games that you could theoretically never play again, which, and it's not so much, again, it's not so much the delisting that bothers me. It's the, even if you've already bought it, you're not going to be able to download it again.
No, I agree that sucks if that's true.
Like, yeah, and so then what does it mean, like, if you've bought the physical copy of it? Like, I don't know,
because a lot of those episodic games, there's only like one episode on the disc and the rest are downloaded.
Yeah. And so it's just like, again, great. So now I have to go off and get a hard drive for this shit.
Yeah.
Which I wanted to anyway.
I was going to say, you should have an external hard drive.
Yeah. I mean, we'll have a conversation about what to get, you know, after this show's over, but, yeah.
Speaking of the show stuff, you're here to review a game. We should probably get to that.
Yeah, I guess.
So the next game to talk about tonight is called Super Tennis Blast, developed and published by Unfinished Pixel. Released May 24th on Xbox One, Switch, Steam, and PS4 for $14.99. Smash that ball and have a real blast enjoying the best tennis. Start your professional career in World Tour mode, then train your skills and become a tennis legend playing on courts around the world. Jacob, tell us about Super Tennis Blast.
Well, it's a very arcadey tennis game. I'd even suggest it's kind of like a Mario Tennis Lite, if that gives you an idea for it. Mm-hmm. And there's a decent amount of depth in this game. Like, it's not like a story mode, but there is like a career mode to it, and you're trying to get your tennis player, you know, to go from rookie to, you know, world champion by the end of the year.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that. Of course, you could just do one-on-one stuff. You could train. But it really seems like the main idea behind this game is multiplayer, which unfortunately, I didn't get to do any of it because the game doesn't have online capabilities. It's only local multiplayer, which, admittedly, I could see it being really fun, like gathering like two or four friends, and, you know, you just run all over the court and, you know, just cause a general ruckus, as much as you can have at tennis matches.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's not much of a ruckus you can have at tennis matches. I mean, whatever. So unfortunately, like, I didn't get to test out the multiplayer. I played through the career mode, and I will say this, like, the gameplay is generally solid. Hitting the ball never felt like an issue. It's fairly intuitive. The game tutorial is fine. It handholds you, helps you understand what to do. Of course, if you want to repeat the lesson again, you can. Which I thought was a nice touch, because, you know, there was a couple of times with some of the hits, like, I wanted to test it more than just 10 shots, like, all over the court. So, you know, I liked that. And then the career mode, I tried doing that. And also, first off, if remember, this is like a very arcadey thing. Nothing is licensed. So you will not get to play off against, you know, like Andre Agassi, Arthur Ashe, anybody like that.
Timely references, man.
Yeah. Do you know how often I watch tennis, man? I'm referencing what I remember reading in like Sports Illustrated for Kids when I was a kid. So I don't know who's big right now. Who's big in tennis, Joe? Do you actually watch tennis?
No, but I'll at least admit it.
Hey, I would admit it too, but nobody's asked, hey, Jacob, do you watch tennis?
Jacob, do you watch tennis?
No! Fuck no! The hell kind of question is that? Do I look like somebody who watches tennis? Have you seen me in real life? No. I got raggedy breathing just watching tennis. What the heck? No. Good lord. Okay, anyway.
So no Andre Agassi in the game. Got it.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, there are no world famous courts to be found. They're set in the cities, wink, wink, where, you know, certain things are held. But, no, it is not like, you know, you will not find the exact replica of Wimbledon to be found here. But, you know, I mean, it's serviceable enough. And then the career mode, I like, and this is where I was having my biggest issue with, because the one aspect of the game I wasn't that fond of, which coincidentally enough is also what I'm not fond of in real life, is running around on the court.
Okay.
I made a fat joke. Come on, man. It was good. I'm
fat too, so it just...
Did it hurt you? Home.
Yes.
Did it hurt you?
Took my breath away.
I'm sorry. Go drown your sorrows in another, like, vat of melted butter.
I should. Oh, that sounds good.
I know. Some good old-fashioned Paula Deen cooking.
Yeah. Anyway. Running around the court.
Yeah. So running around the court, the controls oddly didn't feel quite right while doing it. And it honestly kind of felt like my guy's feet were made out of clay. And even on the easiest setting, it was real easy to like to just straight up miss and not be able to get the ball where I thought it was going to. I used to play, it wasn't Topspin. What was the Microsoft version back on the old Xbox? Was it called Topspin?
I thought it was Topspin.
I think it might have been. I used to play the ever-living shit out of it on the Xbox. I loved that game. And then also my old roommate, John, you know, we used to scream at each other over Rockstar Table Tennis. So, I mean, it's like I'm no stranger to games of where you're hitting balls with a racket, which is an odd sentence that I never thought I'd say. It's just like, hitting the ball feels right. Running on the court does not. And it really becomes apparent as, like when you start your career mode. I started off on easy and I was having a lot of difficulty, like just catching up with, you know, returning serves and stuff like that. And maybe the game actually wants you to like, you know, maybe you should just spend your first few like months just training, instead of hopping straight into a tournament. Which would have been nice if they had given that hint. And then also when I was just playing like, you know, just regular single player, like, you know, messing around, stuff. I did mess with like the different difficulties. Easy is generally like is easily manageable. Like you should not have issues winning.
Okay.
Medium will occasionally give you a run for your money, but you still should be able to win. And hard just returns every damn serve. Like hard will just it literally is hard.
So the difficulties are accurate. Got it.
Accurate, but at the same time, like it felt hard was like unfairly hard. Like it literally never missed a shot. It always returned everything that you like could throw at it. And so it's just like, I don't know if it's just like there's some sort of secret that I just don't know about, or I need to spend like 50 hours on the game instead of, you know, like 15, 20. I don't know. But, you know, I felt like the game has like a few kinks to work out with its mechanics, but otherwise I thought it was pretty decent.
Well, then minor gripes aside, $15 on it. What do you say?
15's not bad. Personally, I being the cheap ass that I am, I would wait for a sale on this. However, you know, it's a solid, arcade tennis game. And honestly, if that's what you're looking for $15, it's not bad. You know, if this is the kind of game that like you want to play, then by all means, go for it. It doesn't earn the Jacob like, oh my God, go buy it immediately. But for $15, I wouldn't scoff at it either. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
You picky bitch, you.
I am a picky bitch. I'm a cheap bitch. But I'm a you picky are. Bitch because I care.
Sure you do. Jacob, always a pleasure having you on, chatting about these games.
Is it really?
I'm just trying to get through the line with keeping a straight face.
God damn you.
Do you have any final words before we move on?
Jeez, not really, man. I kind of blew my load discussing the whole Telltale Games thing.
All right, moving on. Next game to talk about is called Vasilis, developed and published by Marginal Act, released April 15th on Steam for $8.99. Vasilis is a hand-drawn adventure game. The main character, Vasilis, lost her husband, Peter, in the rebellious city center. The city is in riots for a long time, and almost every day something burns or someone dies. Checking out this happy game, Royal Sefton, how are you doing?
I'm just a ray of friggin' sunshine. How you doing?
Yeah, I could tell. The game just seems very happy and very upbeat and friendly.
It's an uplifting sort of title, you know. Good for the spirits. Yes, inspirational, exactly. It's my inspiration a day calendar in game form. I love it. No, you know, I'm assuming it's Vasilis. I don't know if it's supposed to be pronounced any other way, but we're going to go with that, right?
Yes.
Vasilis? Yeah, okay. So the thing about Vasilis, I want to say, is that it's like a really Soviet, almost earthboundy, very sad and dark kind of game. I don't know how better to describe it than that. It's surreal, but it's not the kind of whimsical surreal that I personally enjoy. It's more of a hellish surreal. But the way that it's implemented is unique, and it may or may not be your cup of coffee. So everything is hand-drawn, which is cool, really cool. But it's, whether intentionally or otherwise, also very inconsistent. You're walking down the street as Vasilis, and you've got people that are like 2 or 3 feet taller than you at least, and they're walking down the street and then suddenly bending over backwards occasionally, like just bizarre stuff. And as you get closer or further away from the screen, because it's like a 2D back and forth, top down ish kind of thing, not quite 3/4 view, but you can be closer or further from the camera. I don't know how to describe it. It's not rendered like 3D at all, but more like Double Dragon, how you can go up and down the road, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's the best way I can describe the art style as it's implemented. The thing is that it's like with everything that's hand-drawn, some stuff gets blown up and it looks kind of blurry, even though it's supposed to be close to you. So it's like the art style, I think, if it were maybe handled with a little more care, it would be more like that. I want to say Neverending Nightmares is the Steam game I'm thinking of that I'm reminded of most, where it uses black and white, kind of an ink hand-drawn art style to great effect. Vasilis accomplishes a lot of those same ideas, but it does them, I think, with a little bit less care, which, you know, I kind of wish it was done a little differently so that everything stayed nice and sharp and focused. To that end, the thing about it is that everything is kind of wiggly and animated. Think like Dr. Katz or, you know, the video for Take On Me by A-ha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Squiggle vision.
Yeah, squiggle vision, except it's kind of like a combination of those two, where you have shading lines and things kind of shake and shimmer and grow. But it can be very distracting, like trees on the side of the road. They kind of move more than some people do, and some people and their desks kind of shake around. It's really, it's somewhere between unnerving and distracting. So sometimes I think it's done to great effect, and sometimes I just want to stop for a moment because I get a headache just looking at it.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I got to pause for just one sec. All right. Sorry about that.
All good.
Life. Okay. Gotta love it. Okay. So anyway. As you play the game, I'm sorry, I've been focusing on all these technical things because I guess I'm trying to get the stuff that I found the most distracting out of the way first, or the most challenging.
Yeah.
Okay, so the game is kind of a quasi-linear, I would say point and click, but there's actually no mouse. It's all WASD on the keyboard to walk around, and you explore, and you have an inventory. And so you find an item, you go take it somewhere else, give it to someone else, sell it, whatever. As you go through a series of days trying to find Peter. And at first I was not real sold on if you look at the game's tags, you'll see horror is among them. I didn't really see it as a horror game at first. And so you got to be patient if you're really interested in this. Since it's kind of an avant-garde or experimental game, in my opinion, it can be real trying. But as you get further and further in, yes, it does start to take kind of a dark turn. It's already a little dark when you think about the idea of somebody living in a city of that's in constant riot, and you're looking for your missing husband. That's already kind of dark material, but it just gets really bizarre, strange, and even a bit revolting, shall we say, as you get further in. Yeah, and I don't want to spoil it, but it comes down to, are you going to find Peter in one place or several? That's as much as I'm going to say.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's an interesting game. And I think that it's definitely going to defy genre a little bit. Like I said, it made me think kind of point and click, because you're, you know, kind of doing the item fetching quest. But there are so many, like, just bizarre quirks, whether it's the art style or the writing, which seems to have some combination of continuity and translation errors. I don't know. Actually, I think they're almost beneficial to the way the game feels. just trying to sort out, what the hell am I doing here? And why are things always this chaotic? It's a bit of a puzzle game, you know, but, it's definitely one of the strangest trips I've been on. In quite a long time as far as games go.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of came into it feeling a bit lukewarm. I feel better about it after being patient with it. And that's what I would encourage anybody who's interested in checking this out.
Well, then for $8.99, what is your official verdict?
So you could probably work through this in an hour or two. But if you're willing to take the time to explore, and like I said, if you're patient with it, and maybe bring a painkiller, because sometimes maybe it's just me, the art style and the sort of like combination of things in motion, and then later on it starts to get really warpy, can be a bit trying. If you're willing to stick with it, I think for $9 it's a try it. It's definitely a try it, because it's an interesting and very unique flavor.
Awesome. Sounds good. Royal, always a pleasure having you on the show chatting. Do you have any final words before we move on?
No.
All right. And finally, we're moving on to Chris Taylor. Chris, how are you doing?
Hey, doing all right.
How was your weekend?
Every time we record on Tuesday, I don't remember. lots of tracking for the Gimmick album. I remember that much.
That's good.
Yeah, we're a little over halfway done now, I think.
How many songs is it looking to be?
It's going to be 12 tracks.
Nice.
But, you know, some of those tracks will contain multiple songs, so.
Ooh, medleys?
Yeah, that's what we do. But, you know, we like to mix it up and stuff. But, it's coming together so far. Really excited about it.
Do you have any kind of release window in mind yet?
We're trying for, by the end of summer, having it out at least on Bandcamp.
Nice. So,
yeah. But we don't have, we aren't even going to name a date until it's done. Like, you know, it's bad luck to do so.
Yes, like when you did a podcast appearance for your album a couple years ago.
Like 6 years ago, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah, that was something of a false start. We thought we'd go with an external, like a studio. And so we started going into the studio, and then like we just racked up a lot of cost really quickly without getting a whole lot done. And then like, so we were like, we got to approach this differently, I think. So that's just how that went. But yeah, no, this time we're doing it. It's, you know, we're self-producing, and but it's from the same drummer who recorded that Toe Jam and Earl stuff, and that's what he can capture live. So
damn,
I think the result of a not live situation is going to be even better.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
When it's ready to go, we'll have to play some stuff on the show.
Absolutely.
And you can introduce it.
Ooh. Like, that's what I've always wanted to do.
Introduce your own music? I mean, you did it technically last week.
That is true. But that was a yeah, that was kind of a different thing. For one, it was much faster.
True.
I'm looking through the list of games that Kemco has that isn't available on any of the consoles, like just their app games and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think it's something like, they got like 90 games listed on their site.
Holy hell.
Yeah. Which is interesting. It's also interesting that they list stuff like Sword of Hope 2, which was a Game Boy game that they came out with back in the 90s, but since it is currently available on 3DS, it does have a listing on their site.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, anyway.
Virtual console on 3DS?
Yes, virtual console on 3DS.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
I might have to look that one up.
Yeah, Sword of Hope is pretty cool because it's kind of like Shadowgate if it had enemy encounters.
Hmm.
So, but it's still one of those things where you choose menus to like go to the next screen kind of thing, and you know, you solve puzzles and all this other stuff. It's just sometimes you have to also fight stuff.
Which is good. Fighting is good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Keeps things entertaining.
Indeed.
Speaking of being entertaining, should we tackle some reviews?
Oh yeah, that's what we're here for.
All right, you're here to talk about three games. We're going to start things off with Gato Roboto, developed by Doinksoft, published by Devolver Digital. And between Gato Roboto and Doinksoft, I am in heaven with their names.
I know, Doinksoft is great.
Doinksoft, lowercase great. Too, Doinksoft. Yeah.
Great, great job on the name, guys.
Love it. Anyway, Gato Roboto released May 30th on the Switch for $7.99. Pounce inside of your cozy armored mech and set off in a dangerous trek through an alien underworld full of irritable creatures and treacherous obstacles in a valiant effort to save your stranded captain and his crashed spaceship. Chris, tell us about Gato Roboto.
All right, Gato Roboto is a, and this is their words, it's a Meowtroidvania.
Yes. I love it.
But as soon as you start playing this, it becomes very apparent that it leans much more heavily on the Meowtroid side of it, Meowtroid side of it, rather than the Ulvania part of it. Because, yeah, this is literally just a take on a kind of Metroid or Super Metroid game. You'll recognize things like the missiles and the regular shots and like the shooting bubble doors to open them. There's, you know, it's very, very blatant. There's clearly some, you know, strong inspiration taken here. So, the story of Gato Roboto is that you are Kiki, the cat who is owned by a dude who decided to take his cat up into space. I don't know. And yeah, he crashes his ship into an alien planet and he's injured and stuff. And so it's up to his cat to save the day. And of course, the first thing that you find as Kiki is a mech suit. And so you then become a cat who is piloting a mech suit and you have to explore this alien world and try to, you know, try to save the day. And and of course, one of the things that happens is, of course, the game has to introduce the rival to our cat hero. And so who do they pick but a mouse? Just a mouse.
A like, plain old mouse?
Yeah, that also pilots a mech.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that we need something a little more than just a mouse.
Yeah. And of course, what I love about this game is that the human character speaks in gibberish. It reminds me a lot of Chibi Robo on the GameCube, if anybody remembers that one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, he's got the blah, 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 blah. I guess sim speak is another way of saying, you know, human voice gibberish. And, but the cat, like, actually, you know, meows and the mice squeak and stuff, but they actually aren't translated. So it's just meow, meow and squeak, squeak. So, but anyway, so yeah, the game is charming as heck. So what really kind of sets it apart, I suppose, in this thing is that, for one, you're piloting a mech and you're able to push a button to jump out of the mech and explore as the cat. And the cat by itself, of course, is, vulnerable. It can be destroyed in one hit from an enemy, which of course the enemies in this game are either Metroid inspired or just like frogs, just regular frogs that just jump around and don't actually attack you or anything. They just do damage if you hit them, so you have to destroy them. So there's a little bit of a too cute to kill factor here. But yeah, the cat can actually explore and can climb up walls and can swim in water. And there's a great little cutscene about the cat not wanting to swim in water, but then having to be sort of talked into it, which is great. And then actually, you know, once you unlock a little bit more of the map and, you know, defeat a boss and all this other stuff, then you get into the water and discover that actually there's submarines down there that you can pilot. So that actually sort of turns this game into more of a kind of a Metroid and Blaster Master feeling type of thing, because you do have to solve puzzles in a weakened state before jumping back in your mech and being able to, you know, take more hits and, you know, actually do, shoot things. Cause like as a cat, you can't even open a door because cats can't open doors. I mean, it's mostly cause you're not in your mech suit to shoot the door to open them, but I like that that real life fact is still in there. So,
The more you talk about this game, the more I'm falling in love with it.
Oh no, this game is spectacular. I mean, I was going to save that till closer to the end, but I mean, it moves like silky smooth. It's absolutely perfect on controls. There's like nothing about the controls that will annoy you. It's like, you know, Metroid, but a little more modern. Of course it has the map, the auto map, that you can, you know, push the cross button and get, yeah, it just, oh, and the aesthetics of it, of course, are worth noting because, the entire game is done in black and white. There's no actual color in it. However, you can I actually did this. You can change it to, like different grayscales, you know, and different like types of monochrome, mm-hmm. but it is essentially a black and white game.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the soundtrack is really interesting because, despite the fact that this is clearly a comedic take on a kind of, you know, Metroid style game, the music is very, like, authentic. Like, it's, you know, heavy synths and very, like, ambient. And, you know, it's got that kind of isolation feeling. So, you know, these guys at Doinksoft certainly know their source material, and they just kind of took it to the next level, and they made it all about a cat, and I just adore that.
In a mech suit.
In a mech suit, yeah, or a submarine, or who knows what else once we get further in. Like, I'm really excited to see what else is in this game, because it's very clearly, like, as much as I played it, I got, you know, I got a whole bunch of the map uncovered. I'm uncovering another area now, but I think I'm only, like, 15% through the game, so it's, like, really a full-size game. Which, you know, kind of impressed me given the price point.
Yeah, so $8 on it, what do you say?
Yeah, $8, don't let this one pass you by, because people, once this one, you know, I guess the guy who is credited for coining the phrase Metroidvania basically described it as a perfect game. That would be the internet's Jeremy Parrish, which means he probably rated it an 8.5. And but, you know, so I think that this game's going to get a little bit of attention. And once it does, I think people are going to start really talking about this one because it's pretty dang awesome. So I definitely suggest that you get on this one. I mean, Metroidvania fans and just fans of action games in general will love it. And of course, like I said, you know, it's what can go wrong with a cat-based video game.
And you've covered a number of them.
Yeah, I actually, once I get a blog up and running again, which I'm waiting to get my computer fixed to do, I mean my main computer, then I actually do want to write up a top 9 list of cat games on the Switch.
Top 9, I see what you did there.
Yeah. Wasn't just because I couldn't decide on 10.
By the way, just so you know, while you were explaining the game and doing the review, I bought the game.
Nice. So, see, we're selling them already.
Between you, your review, and Purnell earlier, after I finished recording with him, he asked what games you were taking care of. He said if you didn't like Gato or Bato, you're a dummy, dummy, dumb, dumb, dummy, dumb, 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 or something along those lines.
I'm glad that I'm glad I didn't fall for such a trap. I've met and or succeeded Purnell's expectations of me.
Yes, you have.
Yeah, this game is clearly quality. I mean, it is like glistening. This is a very, very good game. So
awesome. Yeah. Good to hear.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Legend of the Tetrarchs, developed by XCreate, published by Kemco, released June 6th on the Switch for $14.99. The holy sword that sealed away an ominous power has been drawn out and darkness starts to spill out across the land, mutating people into monsters. The four Tetrarchs heroes of ancient times will meet a new band of brave warriors to slash through the darkness with the light of courage. What will they find beyond the chaos? Chris, tell us about it.
Well, first, I have to give you a minor correction here. This is not an XCreate RPG. This is from Hit Point.
Is it?
Yes.
My info had XCreate.
Yes.
So I must be wrong.
Some do. I noticed as well, like, when I was kind of looking at other reviews, some people were like, Kemco and XCreate. And I was like, no, no, no. It's Hit Point. Which, of course, Hit Point you would know from, I mean, always at first glance, they look like they're going to be an XCreate game, but the Hit Point games are like Machine Knight and Christianos, however you pronounce that one. I covered that one once, and I don't think we ever landed on a proper pronunciation of it.
Probably not.
But no, this is a Hit Point and Kemco game.
All right, so, I will have to update the show notes for that, because even on Nintendo's website under developer has XCreate.
Whoa, so, weird.
Yeah.
Well, on Kemco's website, if you scroll to the bottom, it has 2019 Kemco/Hit Point copyright, but also in the actual game it says Hit Point. So,
all right. Yeah, I'm looking at the copyright information on the Nintendo page, and it does say Kemco Hit Point.
Well, so, we were just talking about how Kemco has like 90 games out there, so
very true.
Like right now, so I don't blame him for letting that get past him. I seem to be the only person who's like really into the Kemco RPGs. So yeah, when I fired this one up and I saw that it was Hit Point, I was like, "Ooh, this is going to be interesting." But you know, it didn't really hit home until I got into the first field of battle and ran into a Poncho. Which, if you don't remember, ponchos are the really cartoony-looking, like, bird blobs that, for whatever reason, Hit Point all, you know, the Hit Point games always have them right at the beginning of the game. And, actually, I got my ass handed to me recently by some ice ponchos, so they're getting fiercer.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay, so, Legend of the Tetrarchs is a, losing my train of thought here. It's an RPG that is in the Hit Point genre. So, Hit Point versus XCreate, they tend to, whereas XCreate kind of like, they make their games, they have like a template, and like their games typically follow the same patterns, but they usually improve upon the formula in some way. Like they add in some kind of stat building thing. They're all about stat building, you know, all about item collecting and, you know, so on and so forth. Usually limited to just four characters and how they interact. Like that's 90% of the, 90% of the usual X-Create games, actually. Like Sephiroth's Stories changes it up a little bit. And of course, they have that, I think Frayn's Dragon Odyssey is like completely different too. So, you know, they're of course branching out. But yeah, so these guys take more of a Dragon Quest approach in that they're very similar at the core, but the game is almost always like really different from the last one. And this one is actually like kind of unique among other RPGs. So, you get into this thing and when you fight battles, there actually aren't any like items. Like items are not a thing in Legend of the Tetrarchs. So, you know, you have to fight and, you know, do damage and heal yourself and everything like that. So you can either attack or you can choose to use one of your skills, which are basically magic spells. Now, there's not really MP or anything that you can restore. What it is it's SP, you know, your skill points, which you can use to use, like, whatever attack is available. And then the SP builds up across, like, your turns as you fight. So basically all the attacks are on a timer, like a turn-based timer. And in fact, the only way that you can heal your characters in battle is to, have a character that can heal first, and then to also, you know, actually use that healing power. So you can't just sort of item your way through a battle, which actually adds like this whole nother layer of strategy, because this game's actually pretty hard. I was impressed by how much the challenge level kind of like spiked up after the second or third dungeon. And the cool thing about it is that it's very much a game of strategy, so I really appreciated that they actually, you know, the battles actually require strategy. They're not just, you know, get out there and, you know, gain a bunch of levels to overpower the enemy like really easily. Because, like, or, you know, like, just item your way through it. Like, everything actually does take a certain amount of thinking. So there's another element to the combat system that is, it's hard to describe without the thing right next to me, so I'm just going to, like, look at it.
Cheat sheet.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, like, Carmina, that's what I was thinking. A specific thing in this called Carmina, where you basically can set your characters up with a passive skill that does certain things. So, like, your main character, Len, has a Carmina that if you find them or acquire them through leveling, or sometimes, you know, like I said, you find them in treasure chests and dungeons and such. So you set the Carmina, and, like, his passive one is where every time he defeats an enemy, he gets to make a slightly weaker slash at some other enemy on the board. And so that's like a thing there. And then, like, one of the characters has a move where every time she uses heal, or, you know, if she attacks something, then she might heal a different character, whichever character has, I think, the least HP at like a 50% chance, and different things like that. And you can actually set all these up and sort of toggle them, or not toggle them, but, you know, you kind of set them up and equip them on your characters, and that actually becomes part of your strategy for getting through much harder battles. And things like reviving your character if they fall, that's like something you actually have to set as a passive move that they can do, rather than just use, you know, like I said, rather than use an item.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it is really interesting. And much like, so, you know, you've got that going for it. The other thing is that you do gain conventional levels, and you also, you know, get conventional money so that you can purchase weapons and armor. The thing has an upgrade system, which is interesting, that you actually can take any item that you can equip, and you can just choose to upgrade it for a certain amount of money, like anywhere on the world map. Like, it, you don't have to talk to a blacksmith or anything, and everything can be raised up to 5 levels. And the, you know, every time your item gains a level, it costs you money, and money is a little bit scarce as far as this game goes, because, well, there's no items to sell. There's just like your old weapons. And you, when you fight enemies, like, there's not a whole lot of gold that drops either. So what the main source of income is for you in this game is actually fulfilling quests, which are, you know, like side quests that are sort of story based. There's always a story based quest, but then it's things like, you know, destroy a certain amount of enemies, and then you basically get like this big amount of bonus cash. One is use a certain move 20 times, and, you know, you get a whole bunch of money that way. And those are actually a really interesting driver, too. And, of course, improving a certain, you know, a number of weapons to level 5 also triggers a, you know, a bonus, like, sort of thing. And the cash prizes with those bonus stages are actually, like, they become, like, a main source of income for the first, like, little few hours of the game, because the enemies are dropping so little gold. And so, yeah, it all becomes about upgrading your characters and, like, setting them up and sort of building the machine, as it were, sort of like building an engine to fight these battles. And, yeah, like I said, these battles get epic. Like, there's, you know, multi-part bosses and, you know, bosses with minions that if you don't defeat them in the correct order, the boss will revive them, and then you have to kind of start over. And,
oh, those are the worst.
Yeah, there's a couple of them in this game. it's actually, it reminded me of a lot of Chrono Trigger in that sense. But the interface, of course, is more like Dragon Quest, in that, you know, you just have your menu at the bottom with your character portraits, and then, you know, the enemies up on the screen. So I'll get more into, I guess I'll get more into, like, the look and feel of the game. So it's very much a 16-bit look. Very intentionally, because the menus are all in, like, HD, like, text and everything like that, but the characters are actually, like, you know, blocky pixel guys.
Yeah.
Which is pretty fun. And then, the enemies are, you know, made of sprites, and they're animated, and they actually look really good in this game, like, versus even other stuff that Hitpoint's done. This is, like, a, this is multiple steps beyond what they've done with, like, you know, Machine Knight or Cristorino. And then I really, really love the music. Like, I don't know who they got to compose this thing, but, like, the songs are very authentically, like, it sounds to me like something from the Sega CD or Saturn era of RPGs.
Nice.
Like, not quite hugely orchestral, but very catchy, and, like, I don't know, I just really, really enjoy it. And the story is also really good. And this is a thing I noticed with Hitpoint. It's, like, not, you have, like, you know, so with an X-Create Chemco RPG, you might have your, you know, you always have your four characters, and they always interact in some way. Usually the way that they set apart characters is that they have some kind of quirk, or some kind of, like, maybe one-dimensional, like, character trait that comes up from time to time. But what I like about the Hitpoint games, and particularly this one, is that it's more about the way the characters interact with each other, and, like, building levels of trust and, like, things like that. And, you know, the way that this game deals with its story is also really interesting, because it's, the Tetrarchs are this, this, like, these heroes that came before and saved the world and then got ascended to, like, deity-like status. So they've got all this, like, super mega power. They're basically on New Game Plus, you know?
Nice.
And your guys are just these, like, annoying people that are following them around because one of them went rogue and burned up their village. So, you know, your character, Len, is just kind of a brat that, like, you know, is following around this, the noble Lloyd, which, actually, the character names, I have to, some of them are really silly, because, like, the great hero that, that the game keeps talking about, and he's on the title screen and all this other stuff, the game has a lot to do with him, and he's one of the original heroes, and his name is Lloyd. It's like, great Lloyd. And, the king of the underworld's name is Jess.
Okay.
Just J-E-S-S, like a night, like a girl you met at college or something.
Nice.
And, yeah, it's just, I just thought that was kind of funny. Like, they have a couple of names that are just, like, these epic titles and then the name is just really plain. And it's not done for laughs. It's just the way they did it. And then, yeah, the game, like, gets into politics and stuff, like, because these deity-like heroes have ascended to the firmament and, you know, they hang out with, like, basically other godlike and angel-like beings. And then, like, the people down on the surface are, like, you know, they have their own things and they have, like, political alliances and stuff. And the game does a great job in the story of, like, unfolding all this stuff. And I found myself really drawn to it. It's not just about, oh, this guy's a bad guy and we got to go take him down. It's like, this guy's a bad guy and he did this thing and we're trying not to get in the hero's way while the heroes are trying to investigate why he's doing this because they knew him as a good guy. And then, you know, then we find out that there's like this other guy maybe pulling the strings or maybe it's vice versa. It's just like really well written in that sense. And I really like that it has an interesting story on top of this interesting gameplay. And actually, back to the gameplay for a second. One thing that I do like about this game, because I probably made the battle system sound a little harrowing. The cool thing about this game to me is that in regular battles and all this other stuff, there is no manual recovery. That is to say, every single time you win a fight, everything's back to 100%. So you don't ever have to like heal yourself. You don't ever have to like, that's one thing that I had to get used to in this game is that you don't have to backtrack to go heal yourself or replenish items because there are no items to use. And every time your character leaves the battle, they are at 100%. So they don't have to do it. You don't have to do anything else. Just walk, you know, keep going.
I like when games do that.
Yeah, and that's, I was clearly not used to it. And it was really funny, too, because, like, the first couple of inns you run into, like, you can pay to stay at the inn, and I don't know what the reason for that is, but they're extremely expensive, so I just haven't. So, I don't know. But yeah, Legend of the Tetrarchs, it's, I really, really enjoyed this one. I actually think this is the best one Kemco and Hitpoint have put out so far. And they haven't put out a lot on, like, Switch. I don't know what they've been doing for Xbox or PS4, but, like, I know they've been doing 3DS type stuff, and I always like their games, but this one is actually, like, I'm really gonna knuckle down and, like, beat this one, I think, because I'm really interested in the story, and I really enjoy the battle system.
Nice. Well, overall, $15 on it? What do you say?
Yeah, $15. If you are curious about Kemco RPGs, and it, you know, you're looking at them and there's just this, like, you know, intimidating amount of them out there. This is, I'm going to call this one one of the at least three best that I've played so far. And I've played dozens of these things by now. Because on top of this podcast, I bought a lot of them myself, too. So, yeah, like, I would say absolutely give this one a look. It's going to be, you know, it's a little different from what your conventional JRPG might be, but I think everything that they do differently is for a reason, and I think that it actually makes the game more engaging, I would say. So yeah, $15, absolutely worth it.
Awesome, sounds good.
Yeah.
One final game to talk about tonight is called Arcade Archives Butasan, developed and published by Hamster, released May 16th on the Switch for $7.99. Butasan is an action game that was released from Jellico in 1987. Players try to survive while throwing time bombs at each other. Can you survive the gauntlet of 100 fellow pigs to become the champion pig? Chris, are you the champion pig?
Maybe, I don't know. I guess it depends on how many quarters I dump in. Yeah, Butasan. I forgot that it's a Jellico game. That's pretty interesting. I thought it was like Irem or something. But yeah, so, Butasan, which, of course, translates to Mr. Pig, is obviously. there's actually not a whole lot to say about it. It's a game where you run around a field as a pig, and there are bombs on the ground, and you pick up those bombs and throw them at the other pigs until you're the last pig. And, yeah, as so yeah, each of the bombs that are on the ground are basically numbered, and so when you pick one up, the timer starts going down. So the idea is to kind of throw it at the other pig and hope that they get in the blast radius by the time the thing hits zero. Or if you're fast enough, which this game actually moves really fast, I'm kind of impressed. But maybe I'm just like maybe I'm just looking at the year 1987 and forgetting that actually there were a lot of great games back then.
Oh, yeah.
But this game runs really smooth, so I like that. But yeah, if you can actually hit them directly with the bomb, then that gets rid of them too. And if you can get more than one in the same blast, then of course bonus points. Periodically, items drop down and you can get them and you get bonus points. The game is very, you know, it's very Japanese looking. You know, all the pigs do like old anime faces and things like that, which is great. and the funny thing is about the pigs is that the way that you tell your player pig apart from the other pigs is that they're naked, but you're wearing boxer shorts.
Okay.
So, yeah. So you're overdressed for the party, I suppose. And then there's a couple of other things, like there are power-ups that you can get, such as a backpack, which allows you to hold two bombs. So if you throw the one bomb, then the other bomb appears in your hand at the, you know, number at which you picked it up. So it's not like the bomb in your backpack's going to blow up or anything like that.
That's good.
My favorite power-up is the armor, which allows you to take one hit before you lose a life. But the armor is a dinosaur suit. Like, clearly a dinosaur suit, like your face is sticking out of it. I don't know. Now the 80s
were weird, kids. The 80s were weird.
Dig it. I don't know. I think now is weird, too.
True.
It's just,
different weird.
Yeah, different weird. This is classic weird, though, which is great. So, yeah, you get three lives in which to meet your goals. And, of course, if you lose your three lives, you just have to pop in a continue, and you start off at the same stage that you just left. You know, like I said, it's stage-based, so you essentially have three lives in which to beat the stage. But if you keep beating stages, obviously you rack up more score, and, you know, the idea is to try and clear it without getting any kind of game over. You know, I like that they give you three chances there. The other thing is that every few levels, there is a bonus level, which is still running around the field, but this time you're actually just using the bomb-throwing button to hit pigs as they come out of holes in the ground. So it's basically whack-a-mole. Like, you know, occasionally a gold, silver, or red pig will come out, and you bop them for even more points, and, you know, it's just, literally, it's just for score, but it's nice. It's a nice addition. Yeah, so a couple of things. I guess the game appears to be two-player, but I couldn't figure out how to get it to get into that mode. I might have to look. But I think that in two-player mode, it's just switching players rather than having them both on the screen at the same time. Not too sure about that one, but the game purports to be two-player anyway. The one thing about it, about is this port in particular, like, you know, with Hamster and everything, is that they did, of course, provide an accurate, emulation of this game with all the, you know, quality of life options that you'd come to expect from Hamster, such as difficulty, extra lives and things like that, being able to be adjusted and sound and borders and all that great stuff. The one thing they didn't do is make an English version. So.
Really?
Yes, this game is just the Japanese version. Therefore, there's a lot of comedy that kind of gets lost in it if you can't read Japanese. Interestingly enough, I watched a gameplay video of this game to be like, is there any even an English version? And I guess there's a translation out there somewhere that that seemed bad, so I don't think it's actually a fan translation, so maybe there's an American version of this floating around. But apart from key things, you know, you can play the game. All the text in Japanese is just for flavor. Mm-hmm. So all the menus are in English and such. And, you know, there's not much to say in the game. So, but yeah, there's a lot of, like, meet the pigs. And, like, it actually gives you a description of each different colored pig. And, like, some of them have, like, sunglasses. And one of them is clearly, like, a sporty guy. And, you know, they just have, like, these different characters. A little bit like how Pac-Man does, but it, like, introduces them every couple levels or so. And I don't know what they're saying about them because I don't read Japanese. And so that's the kind of thing that's kind of getting lost in translation here. But, you know, that's, if there was no English version available, then I can't blame them for not having one.
True.
So I guess that just bears looking into. But this is a fun game. It's light and breezy. It's fun to play, which, you know, I can recommend it to today's audience, rather than something like Elevator Action where we have to be like, you had to be there at the time, you know, kind of thing. Now this one I think actually is really fun. It's very simple. And there's lots of levels and a pretty good little variety of, you know, different stages. And the difficulty ramps up very sufficiently. Like, they really fill that screen up with pigs.
Nice.
And when it gets that way, it's super nice to, like, throw a bomb and, like, have it blow up and take out, like, five of them at a time. Even if you're one of them.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, minor gripes aside with the language, $8 on this one. What do you think of Buddha-san?
$8, I mean... Man, that's the price for literally any arcade game that you could possibly want on the Switch. So thinking of it that way, it's hard to recommend it over, you know, so many, you know, all-time favorites. I think that this game has an audience. I just am not sure what that audience is. However, if you do decide to take the plunge and get this game, I definitely think that it's a very good one. So I do recommend it. I'm just, you know, it's just thinking of all the great stuff hamsters put out there. You know, I'm trying to picture the one who's chomping at the bits for Buddha-san.
True.
I was excited about it, though, so maybe it's me.
You were the one.
They found their audience. I'll tell you what, if you want to get up there in the world rankings, this one's pretty empty so far. I played it a little bit in caravan mode, and I actually was like, oh, I'm actually getting really close to ranking. Nice. So there you go. If you want to be the master of an arcade game that no one else is playing, pick up Buddha-san today.
Be the champion pig.
Yes, be the champion pig.
Oh man, well that is it for this episode. A lot of games to talk about. This has been a busy one. So thanks again to Purnell for coming on. Thanks to Royal and for Jacob for coming on. Chris, thank you as always for being here.
Thank you, Joe.
Music, we're going to play a couple more songs from the 1UP's new album because I'm loving it and listening to it a lot, so I want to play more of it. And I guess that is it. Chris, do you have any final words to end the show?
I think it's be the champion pig.